now, fresh from the musty stacks of some distant, unheard-of library, here is our historian in residence, Felix Bunnell. You've been to Pierce County, eh? Looking at historic buildings?
Actually, this story was reported from Fort Wallingford. I did this one remotely.
Fort Wallingford.
Yeah, kind of a musty basement there near Lake Union.
All right, so this is your report.
Kind of threw you there, Dave. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just Port Wallingford, I believe, is where you hide out, right? Most
yes,
of the time.
That's
okay.
It.
So let's talk about what is it? Fort Steilacoom.
Fort Steilacoom. Yeah, yes. This is okay. So first of all, history is so important to community. I mean, these organizations help create and strengthen the whole concept of being a community. I'm a firm believer in that concept. They come in all shapes and sizes. The great ones are able to make a lot out of a little. Volunteer passion goes a long way. Community support is important, too. We talk about grassroots history and preservation projects a lot here, like that Neon group a week or so ago, the people down at the Parkland School. Those are the stories I love. Now, so down near Lakewood, on the grounds of Western State Hospital, is historic Fort Steilacoom, one of the earliest permanent U.S. Army posts in what's now Washington. It even predates the creation of Washington Territory for a few years. Walter Neary is the board president of the nonprofit Historic Fort Steilacoom Association.
So in August of 1849... the infantry established a foothold. And then in 1857, 1858, two dozen, quote, permanent, unquote, buildings were established. We still have four of them today. And it's those four buildings that we share as a museum.
Now, the Army left Fort Steilacoom a long time ago, way back in 1868. Those buildings were repurposed as part of an asylum, the 19th century version of a mental hospital, and that Western State is still there now. Walter Neary's group, Historic Fort Steilacoom Association, they were founded 40 years ago to preserve the four remaining buildings, which were originally officers' quarters. And those buildings probably wouldn't exist anymore without that effort 40 years ago. So the buildings and the land they sit on are owned by the Washington State Department of Social and Health Services, or DSHS. The museum has a lease agreement, one of those dollar-a-year sorts of things. The utilities, security, mowing the grass, that's all paid for by DSHS, the state agency that owns and operates Western State Hospital. Now, across the street from the old fort buildings is Fort Steilacoom Park. It's about 340 acres. It was transferred from state ownership to the city of Lakewood back in 2018. Walter Neary wants a new landlord. It's not that he's dissatisfied with DSHS, but he thinks it could be different under a new regime. He sees an opportunity. He says that every other historic fort he can find is owned and administered by a state park agency or the National Park Service or by some local jurisdiction or county.
We're not aware of any museum of national significance that's administered by a behavioral health facility. Yeah. So we're trying to get what I'd like to do is steer Fort Steilacoom into a safe harbor. The city of Lakewood is a really responsive local government that can help us with some of the really complicated stories we've got to tell. And so I look at the city of Lakewood as a rescuer if DSHS will and the legislature will go along with it.
So again, DSHS owns Fort Steilacoom and they lease it to the nonprofit. They don't do any history or museum activity, DSHS, but they are responsible for the infrastructure and the upkeep, and they have been, since time immemorial. So I checked with Bob Huenthal. He's director of capital programs for DSHS, or in other words, the land and facilities guy.
Without having further discussions with our executive leadership, we are not interested in giving up any more land or property at Western State Hospital's campus. The buildings themselves, we might have discussions about transferring those, but the underlying property we need to keep because of the other critical infrastructure and roads and parkings and things that run across that parcel.
And Bob Huenthal says there was a conversation earlier this year between DSHS and the City of Lakewood Parks Department about transferring the real estate. He says the City of Lakewood wants to own that real estate, not just lease it. He thinks because they can legally use their hotel motel visitor tax proceeds to invest in restoring and enhancing the old buildings. A lot of times you have to actually own the thing to be able to put tax money into it. And this is what Bob Huenthal says about that.
And I think the city's perspective was if they don't own the asset, then they can't use their tax proceeds to benefit it. And so they were going to go back and see if we were to simply deed the buildings over to them, but have DSHS retain the property if that was something they could work with. And we have not had a response back from City Parks since then.
So the idea is you'll give the buildings, but DSHS keeps the land. And I reached out to the City of Lakewood, and a spokesperson there put me in touch with a member of the Lakewood City Council named Dan Anderson. He said he wasn't aware of the Parks Department conversation that Bob Huenthal told me about, where DSHS said they might consider transferring the buildings, but not the real estate. But Council Member Anderson also told me the Lakewood City Council has formally adopted and made it a legislative priority to secure ownership of the entire Fort Silicon site, buildings and land from DSHS. So I asked him, you know, if that's the case, is it all or nothing? If DSHS can only transfer the buildings and not the land, are they not interested?
Oh, and I did say that. That would depend on the terms of the land lease. What you don't want is a situation where you get buildings, you invest money and staff time in enhancing them, you build a program, and you have a third-party entity saying, we're going to control the hours, or we're going to control the access, or we're going to control this.
So there's likely some deal-making ahead, probably involving the state legislature, you know, with a timeline that's to be determined. It's all about control. Now, meanwhile, back over at the fort, Walter Neary says, until ownership, you know, the ownership situation changes, he feels like their hands are tied as far as doing more fundraising and making their organization grow to what they believe it could be.
And that's what I think has been hard on our volunteers, is that we're all sitting around thinking, well, we really ought to be like Fort Vancouver or Fort Nisqually, because we have these great stories. But, you know, we are our parent organization is a mental hospital, and this is not how things are supposed to work. Hospitals and museums are different things. And in Washington, we've normalized it that, oh, yeah, hospital, museum, same thing. But they're not. You really need a skill set applied to a museum.
Now, I gather there are things that neither side is really revealing about, maybe tension in the relationship between DSHS and this nonprofit group. Because I push back against Walter Neary. If I had a state agency paying my utilities to mow my lawn, to run security, kind of taking care of all that kind of bothersome infrastructure stuff, and I just had to worry about interpretation and programming, I would be raising money for doing that.
Like, sounds like he's worried, though, that because of the expansion of mental health treatment, they might want to actually use the land and move the building somewhere.
You know, I think they're probably, with that in mind, they'll probably pursue some kind of a historic landmark designation for the buildings, and DSHS says they wouldn't stand in the way of that. I mean, I think the conversation is going to go on at a higher level, and ultimately over the next couple of years, there'll be some wrestling involving the legislature doing what they did with the parkland 5 years ago there to create the park across the street.
I know, another special session.
Yeah. It only takes a day. It's so fast.
You can probably get it to happen, Felix. Our resident historian, Felix Spinell, all his features are at MyNorthwest.com. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The former CEO of the failed Silicon Valley Bank went before the Senate Banking Committee for a bipartisan flogging, from what I saw. CBS's Jim Krasula covered this. So did he accept the blame for what happened, Jim?
In a way, yes, Dave. In a way, no. One of the things that struck me, that this testimony from this former CEO, he talked about what he called an unprecedented social media-fueled run on the bank. He talked about the fact that one day last month, or back at, actually in early March, $42 billion was withdrawn from that bank in 24 hours. You mentioned members of both parties, and that was striking too, Dave, and that, certainly a change. We saw bipartisan skepticism, I think, and these senators on both sides of the aisle seemed very unimpressed by these former CEOs. They said, among other things, they weren't aware of the bank's troubles ahead of the government taking these banks over, them being the banks collapsing and then being taken over. A former SVB Silicon Valley Bank CEO Greg Becker defended selling millions, tens of millions of dollars worth of bank stock just really in the hours, Dave, before that bank collapsed.
Yeah, what a coincidence. Also, he apparently had a salary in 2022 of $9.9 million. That's what annoys people, is that the guys who made the bad decisions very often come out a lot richer. So what is the Senate, what is the banking committee likely to do about this, if anything?
Well, they're going to try to come up with new regulations, obviously. But I can also tell you, separately yesterday, there was a second Senate hearing, and the Federal Reserve's top regulator told this Senate committee that the Fed is eyeing stricter rules on banks, Dave, with over $100 billion in assets in the wake of these three bank failures back in March.
So is there any appetite for some sort of punishment, which was lacking after the 2008 collapse?
Right. There was some discussion about that yesterday, primarily, as you can guess, on the Democratic side of the members of the Senate Banking Committee, including Chairman Sherrod Brown, a Democrat from Ohio. And he even asked outright, quoting him, "Why did you ignore admonitions from regulators about your bank being in trouble?" And again, they were wishy-washy on answering that question, basically saying, "Hey, we didn't see this coming." Now, one of the things that was mentioned by, again, these former CEOs of these banks, they were talking about the fact that part of the reason that their banks got into trouble was the Fed's action to try to address inflation, specifically the continued raising of interest rates. Quote, one of the CEOs said, "Well, nobody saw that coming." Well, that had been going on for quite some time, obviously.
Yeah. Is there a way, for example, in Greg Becker's case, where he gets $9.9 million, is there a way to claw that back? They've considered legislation before, haven't they, to actually take back the money from CEOs who screw up in a big way?
That's right, yes. And they talked about that again. Will that happen? Probably not. But that's something they're looking at. And, of course, also the whole issue of selling the enormous amount of bank stock that he sold, as I mentioned, just really in just the hours before this bank failed, looking at more than $30 million worth of stock he sold.
I know. Some people just have great timing, Jim. I guess that's what it is.
Yeah, I would guess so. Maybe a premonition, Dave.
Yeah. So is this the end, or are there more hearings to come?
Well, they did say the Democrats, at least on the Senate committee, said that we'd like to. We may want to hear from you again as we go forward to see how we can address this and prevent this from happening again.
I mean, it seems to me the problem is that if you keep letting these guys off, and if deposits are insured by the federal government, this could get very costly. And that's the other thing. Did anybody bring up the decision to make good on deposits over the insured amount of $250,000?
That was also discussed, but again, that's been long standing. And at this point, I don't think that I certainly didn't get the impression from listening to the senators on either side, a Democrat or Republican, that they really have any interest in trying to do that at this point. They probably figure that they just don't have the votes or the appetite, and people just don't have the appetite in the Senate to go ahead and do that, or the House for that matter.
CBS correspondent Jim Krasula. Jim, thanks very much.
Yeah, Dave, always good to talk to you. Stay well.
And the legislature did it. First day of the special session. With a lopsided vote, they pass a new drug possession law. Let's go to Cairo News Radio's Matt Markovich. Everybody wants to know what changed.
Yeah, how about that? They couldn't do it for almost 2 years in a 105-day session, and literally in a couple hours, they passed this drug possession law. Well, they did it because they said, no, we're not going to make any changes after a team of eight lawmakers, two from each caucus, House and Senate, got together, hammered out a deal, and basically didn't allow for any amendments in the House or the Senate. So that would have slowed things down. The Senate voted on it first, 43-6. The House voted 83-13. It was a mix of Republicans and Democrats. It was not a party line vote. People voted their conscience, but they wanted to get it done and get out of there. The bill's original sponsor, Democrat June Robinson, said it was the hardest piece of legislation she's ever had to work on.
Is this bill perfect? Absolutely not. Everyone can and will find something to like and something to not like in this bill.
So the current law expires June 30th. That would have left no law in place on July 1st. And lawmakers have known about it for 2 years, but they couldn't come up with a fix after the session ended April 23rd. So Robinson acknowledged that the pressure the lawmakers were feeling from local governments to get something passed, because those local governments are already starting to pass their own drug use and possession laws.
Everyone agrees that we need a statewide, consistent policy in this space to avoid piecemeal approaches cobbled together by local communities.
So that was it. They realized that the local municipalities are going to take things into their own hands unless the state did something.
That's absolutely correct. And they were sitting there on the wings there for weeks after the session ended, and by golly, the local governments had a big influence on whether they're going to pass something. So they acknowledged that. Now the penalties, because some people don't want any penalties. It's 180 days in jail, $1,000 fine for the first two offenses if they're convicted and the suspect does not choose a treatment alternative, and up to 364 days in jail, which is a gross misdemeanor, and $5,000 fine for every offense after that. Now, this also includes possession of drugs in public places and the use of drugs in public places, which would be a gross misdemeanor. Now, the clock on all this starts on July 1st. That's when the bill takes effect. But many pathways into the treatment process through the criminal justice process, so there's a lot of ways to get avoid jail time. But some lawmakers were upset that the bill now allows for prosecutor's discretion on whether to have a suspect go the alternative route of treatment. Democratic Representative Jerry Paulette didn't like that.
And the prosecutors will leverage that threat into defendants pleading guilty on other crimes, and they will leverage that threat into pushing people into incarceration instead of treatment.
So he's saying that this will be misused by, well, why would a prosecutor want to not put that person into treatment, since that would solve the problem permanently instead of temporarily?
Well, I mean, he's talking about leverage, and he talked about he's going to be watching prosecutors. Just stuff that prosecutors have the discretion now when they work with a suspect that has multiple other charges. Saying, you know, okay, maybe you want to go to treatment. You know, I'll let you go to treatment, but you got to plead guilty on all this other stuff.
See.
So, you know, before, the prosecutor didn't have a choice. They had to go to give an alternative to treatment for a drug possession law, and there was no choice. Now the prosecutor has to agree with it, and that's a big part of this bill. That was a compromise that was worked out. Now, the new law does allow local governments the option to restrict the free distribution of harm reduction supplies. That's what they call them, supplies like drug paraphernalia, like clean needles and smoking pipes. It also requires the Department of Health to notify communities when an opioid treatment center is being planned for their neighborhood. Now, Democratic Representative Lauren Davis says the bill will make it easier for the NIMBY argument to be used when they try to put these treatment centers in that all lawmakers agreed there needs to be more of.
It politicizes essential services and allows life-saving care to be governed by politicians.
And so she says that we need these treatment centers. It's going to be harder to do that. Now, Davis is very active in the addiction recovery causes and summed up what many who oppose the bill and want no criminal option at all in it believe that its approach. She gave her opinion in a very emotional speech on the floor.
This bill upholds the flawed notion that we can punish people into recovery. People don't use drugs because they haven't been to jail enough. People use drugs because they wake up every day to a life they don't want to be living anymore. An existence so intolerable that the only conceivable option is to numb themselves into oblivion.
And within an hour after the House took a vote, the governor signed the bill.
It strikes a sensible, a common sense, and effective policy between accountability and treatment.
And he went on to praise lawmakers for negotiating a bill, even though he had called for a special session to get it done and acknowledged that they couldn't get it done during the regular session. But he still had praise for lawmakers for getting all the elements that he wanted into the bill.
This bill, I think, has been a very thoughtful process rather than some emotional response to a devastating problem.
And when he was asked if he was satisfied with the penalties of the bill, which is basically the incentive to go take treatment, he was satisfied with that.
For some folks, having that sanction to help them make that decision need a shove to get into treatment. And if it takes a little nudge, I'm fine with that.
And what was interesting, Dave, on the political aspect, even though this is an agreement between the leadership, the Republicans and the Democrats, when the governor signed the bill, there was nobody but Democrats behind him. The leadership, there were no Republican leaders of the House and Senate, just the Democratic leaders of the House and Senate and the bill's sponsor. So a very small signing ceremony on such a big bill. And as for the money, which you always like to talk about, the bill ended up adding another $63 million to deal with all the changes that the bill makes, on top of $170 million that was budgeted during the session for treatment centers. So we're talking, you know, $230 million just specifically about dealing with drug treatment regarding the possession law and establishing these treatment centers. And if you thought it was over, well, Republican Representative Tom Dent said, there's always next year.
I don't want to vote no, because we need something, and this is a start. And I'm looking forward to coming back next year, and maybe we can go a little bit further.
So they're going to try and find a way to make people's lives better so that they feel that life is worth living. I'm still haunted by that clip you played from Representative Lauren Davis. What would we do with someone who says, I'm just so miserable, all I can do is take fentanyl?
Yeah, well, that is, I wish I had an answer for that.
Yeah.
I mean, we all do.
I wasn't expecting an answer. It was a rhetorical question.
Yeah, I think, you know, that goes to the heart of why people use drugs and maybe end up committing crimes. And that's the ancillary part about all this, is that this is dealing, you know, this is a, people say this is a health crisis, not a criminal justice problem, because they have a health crisis, which may lead to a criminal justice problem. You got to solve the health crisis crisis first, and that includes what we just talked about there, you know, the desire to live, to have a better life. You know, that is a long answer to a very tough question. So next year, when they're going to try it again, the Republicans are dead set to maybe try and restore it back to a felony, make it a harder penalty. But now we're going to see if it's going to work for at least a year, but they still don't have enough treatment centers to satisfy all the people that they may go into diversion who are arrested by this. And we're going to see how the criminal justice process, that's where the people are going to enter it first, and see how it's happened. Let's see what happens.
Cairo's Matt Markovich. Thank you, Matt.
You're welcome, Dave.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness, brought to you by Robert W. Baird. As you scroll through your social media feeds, how often do you see somebody in need? Sometimes people are just asking for a kind word. Other times, legwork might be required to lift their spirits. Three siblings named Kenny, Kayla, and Dale from Mandan, North Dakota, spotted the former. A young boy on Facebook posted his bike had been stolen with a picture, and he hoped somebody might keep an eye out for it.
I actually got a text message from Dale about, you know, there's on his Facebook post, there's this kid that got his bike stolen. It'd be kind of cool if we can work together and kind of do something to get back. And we kind of grew up in a household where our parents really taught us if there's anything we can do to kind of make someone's day just a little bit better, that we should try to do as much as we can.
So the three decided to forego the search and just buy him a new bike outright.
Dale actually went to
all three of Walmart's in California.
Trying to find something that would be cool enough for him, everything like that, to make him, you know, a little happy and everything, to try to get the same one that he had, or at least something close to what he had.
The boy's family tells KXNet News they're appreciative of the siblings' kindness and hope whoever stole their child's bike will also show some kindness and perhaps return it.
7:48, and now, on loan from the Gian Ursula Show, here he is, G. Scott. So, hey. What did Elon Musk say that set you off?
He did in this interview. He said that it's basically immoral for those to work at home, especially you got people that are coming in to make these cars, right, to build these cars and do all these things and work at Silicon Valley. But you have some people, Colleen, that are staying at home and with their laptops and everything. And they just staying at home, this whole staying at home thing is immoral, and you just need to get back to work. And I thought, the timing of that, right? And what I mean by timing, I think it's very interesting. How come he didn't talk like this in the heart of the pandemic. How come he didn't talk like this in 2020 when all of the essential workers, you know, all of the folks that still had to go into the grocery stores, all of the folks in the agriculture, and all of those folks that were really risking their lives every single day, how come he didn't speak like that and talk about people and management going back to work then? But now you want to choose to do that. You know, Colleen, I'm sure you can speak to this. It is interesting to me how much people care about something that does not really necessarily impact them. And what I mean by that is Tesla. You want to know who was making a lot of cars during that time? You want to know who was really doing well? You know whose stock was doing well during the pandemic? If someone's listening right now and you bought Tesla and you have Tesla, how's your stock doing? How did it do during the pandemic? Doing really good, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm really over this discussion of work from home and working in the building because it's a lose-lose. Everybody feels like they're being put out or it's not fair or, well, they get to do that. Why can't I? You know, it's just like, if you're going to go with that, then, you know, Elon, we can apply that to any situation where, well, because this person can't do it, we shouldn't do it either because it's morally wrong. If you want to work from home, work from home. That's like the if there's any silver linings that come out of a deadly, awful pandemic that has plagued us with substance abuse issues and mental health issues, it's that we found out companies can still be productive and workers can have some work-life harmony. If your job allows it. If it doesn't, you go into work. That's just how it is.
I think it's because Elon Musk's customers, Tesla buyers, are these high-end tech guys who are now no longer needing to drive Teslas back and forth to work. So he's trying to say, get my customers, force them to commute again.
Well, Amazon did.
Yeah.
Are they driving Teslas, Amazon workers?
Probably.
I don't know. Well, there's a whole bunch around here.
I just
don't want to listen to Elon Musk about that stuff. You know?
I say this. For everyone, that is this whole work from home discussion, and it comes up at least maybe once a week. Work from home discussion is coming. Buckle up, buttercup, because here pretty soon, it's going to be the AI discussion. Telling you right now, AI is the thing that we should all be nervous about. You know we should be nervous when the CEO of OpenAI spoke to Congress yesterday and said, we need regulation.
Regulate us, please.
It would be like you going into your mom and dad's room at like 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. Excuse me, mom, dad, hey, listen, I sneak out every night. I really need your help. Can you stop me from doing that? That's what happened yesterday to Congress.
It's smart, though, but that's smart. That means we shouldn't be nervous. The fact that they are self-policing, saying, yeah, we need to rein this in. That's good news.
I'm still trying to figure out how this catastrophe would manifest itself.
What's that?
Right? I mean, they're talking about affecting the election. Nobody believes election ads anyway as it is.
Sure.
So if they start making a bunch of election ads with AI, which are going to sound, I think, pretty clueless, do you think anybody's going to believe that?
Sure. Yeah, I do.
The people already believe QAnon.
Got us into a lot of trouble in this country, Dave.
But you can't change that.
Colleen, before I go, I just want to say why I do believe it's scary.
Okay.
It would be like, okay, this OpenAI, you and I are sitting there talking to bruh from OpenAI, right? Yeah. And we're sitting there and he's saying, gee, Colleen, regulate us. And we're looking at him like, okay, but we don't, you know better than us what's to do. So what do you want us to regulate? Okay, we want you to do this, this, and this, and this. These are the creators of this thing. And they want us who don't understand
They'll tell us what to do. They'll advise.
Right? So mom, dad, listen, I want you to lock these windows and these windows. Well, okay, well, what about this door? No, leave that door alone. Don't worry about that.
I think it shows a great moral compass that he goes before Congress and says, yeah, this is dangerous technology and we need to be regulated. I'm going to stay optimistic.
We have to elect ChatGPT to a congressional seat.
Yes. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
At least they'll show up.
Yeah. All right,
see you guys.
Gia and Ursula at 9 on Cairo News Radio. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The mifepristone decision, where a Texas judge said that you cannot use this abortion pill, is now being appealed to the Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans. Let's go to CBS legal consultant Thane Rosenbaum. What question will the circuit court be trying to decide here, Thane?
Well, a number of ones. One, Dave, is was the doctors who brought this lawsuit in Texas, did they even have legal standing to bring it? Right. So that's always a procedural question that a higher court, especially Supreme Court, is always interested in. Do you have legal standing to bring this case? Are you the proper party to bring it? These were doctors who neither used it nor prescribed the drug. So if you're not prescribing a drug, why are you the doctors that are here? And the argument that they make is that, well, yeah, but because this drug is so unsafe, even if we don't prescribe it, we're likely the doctors are going to have to treat the people who get ill because of the use of the drug. So one is an issue of legal standing, but the larger issue has to do with the authority of a federal judge to substitute his judgment or second guess the decision of the FDA, where the drug has been in use for over 20 years and has been used safely by 5 million people.
Yeah.
And more than 50% of the people who use the drug in the United States use that rather than medical procedure. So that is really, in the end, has a lot to do with issues of federalism. Like, why would a federal judge have more authority or more knowledge to approve, to overturn or suspend a drug that the FDA, which is comprised of scientists and doctors, have already stated 20 years ago that this should be in wider use?
Yes. How is it that a drug that's been pretty much safely used for 20 years suddenly become unsafe? And does that mean anybody could challenge the use of any drug, like, I don't know, Ozempic? I hear the side effects of Ozempic when I look at the commercials. They're terrible. Could anybody just file a lawsuit and get the government to ban that?
That's what they're worried about. That's the main argument that they're saying, is that would essentially put all FDA-approved drugs on notice, that if another federal judge says, you rushed the process. I mean, the Texas judge was basically saying, you didn't, the kinds of protocols that you used to approve this drug were fast-tracked. You were so excited by the use of another way to make abortion legal and to make it easier for women, more access to abortion, that you fast-tracked this drug as if it was a life-saving drug, which gave you the right to not undertake the same kinds of safety protocols you would have taken with another drug. So that was his argument. He's going, come on, guys, you didn't do the kind of work you needed to do, and I'm saying that this drug is unsafe. And so that's the reason I'm making. And, you know, he wrote a very long opinion in which, you know, he's saying, I'm not a doctor, but I've looked at the evidence, and I don't think this drug is safe. The issue, Dave, is very important, is that the court that's going to hear this case today in Louisiana, which is the appellate court, is a conservative court anyway. And all three of the judges were appointed by two were appointed by Donald Trump and one by George Bush. So that's the other issue, which is that, you know, this court in general and this panel in particular is very likely to rule in favor of all, you know, a restriction of abortion rights, which is another reason why everyone is panicked for people who believe in reproductive freedom.
What is the ultimate end game here? Everybody thought that once Roe v. Wade was overturned, that would be it. It would go state by state. But now there appears to be an organized campaign to prohibit abortion nationwide, or at least make it as difficult as possible nationwide, even in states like Washington State, which have on their own decided that you do have the right up to a certain number of weeks.
Well, one end game is for this to go right back to the Supreme Court, right? So that, you know, given what you just said, you have a federal court in Washington State that says, we not only is it safe, but we should expand access to the drug.
Yeah.
Then one other aspect that with this Texas judge suspended was that this drug became available by mail, the generic version. So you didn't even have to make a doctor's visit in order to get the drug. But that was another approval that was rejected by the Texas judge. But The Washington judge said, more freedom. The more freedom you have to get the drug, the better. So whenever there's a split in the circuit, Dave, meaning that one federal court is ruling one direction, the other, that's much more likely the Supreme Court will hear it. Remember, the Supreme Court heard an emergency application a month or two ago, simply to in the wildest cases under appeal, to keep the status quo as it is. Because when the Texas judge originally ruled, he said, we should suspend the drug as of Friday. Friday, nobody can have it. So that's where everyone panicked, and the court, the Supreme Court received emergency applications. And all they were doing was saying, you know what, we're going to lift this suspension and keep the status quo until the appellate process works its way through. So that's what we're doing today, right? What we're doing today is appealing, the Justice Department is appealing the decision of that Texas federal judge on the merits of it. And it goes beyond the immediacy of use, but use just the general decision-making process of the FDA. But I would think that the one end game is for the Supreme Court to hear this case again. Now, remember what they said a year ago, that abortion is not in the business of the court. It's the business of states through their state legislatures. It's a moral decision, not a legal decision. And therefore, it should be political rather than legal. So then, the Supreme Court could say, we told you we don't want to be involved in this.
Yeah.
Why do you keep coming back to us? And the reason is because, Dave, this isn't really, in theory, you hit upon it a moment ago when you said, wait a minute, what about other drugs, right? Because this really, maybe the way to look at this is that the case really isn't about abortion at all, right? It's really about the authority of the agencies, which are filled with experts that make regulatory decisions, right? So it's, this affects not just the FDA, but the EPA, right? All executive branch agencies that are filled with experts. Can federal courts second guess those decisions? So in a way, this case is really beyond abortion. It really is about the right of a federal judge to overturn a decision that was made by experts if he or she thinks they were wrong.
CBS legal analyst Thane Rosenbaum. Thane, thank you very much.
Anytime, Dave. Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.